Michael Cuzzort, C-U-Z-Z-O-R-T. From New Orleans. I joined the Army in 99. It was relatively peaceful back then, and seemed like a good job opportunity and stuff. In 2002, I got sent overseas to Qatar for 6 months, and I went to Afghanistan and Oman in the middle. In Afghanistan, in Qatar, we were sending out supplies to Afghanistan, and then I went there, and I had this old truck, it's a Ford Bronco that the Army doesn't use anymore, and we didn't have any armor on it or no shocks on it or anything. We're driving around this mountainous terrain. And then I got back to Qatar and to another base where we were sending supplies out to Kuwait, which it's been documented now that was for the invasion of Iraq. And this was all a year before the war started, so I knew it was going to start a lot earlier than a lot of people. And so that made me against the war. And just after that, I started opening my eyes, and I could connect all kinds of dots now. Things I just kind of didn't think of before, or took for granted before, or thought that it wasn't my decision or whatever. And then Hurricane Katrina came, and I was stuck in New Orleans with no gas, and I was driving around looking for... I know the Army has these fuel trucks they bring out to places, and you just pump gas right from this truck, but they didn't have that stuff set up for us. They didn't have any kitchen set up or anything like that. And, this is pretty much my story.
Hey, I'm Toby Hartbarger from Indiana. H-A-R-T-B-A-R-G-E-R. I joined the Army in high school. Actually, I was in a delayed entry program. Talked to a recruiter in high school. I think it was lunch hour or something. Before I know it, I was raising my right hand. And within a year of getting out of high school, I was in Iraq. When I joined, the Iraq thing hadn't happened yet. It was 2002. Afghanistan was still going on, but I honestly didn't expect to be sent to Afghanistan. Maybe it was kind of beside that. I spent 15 months in Iraq from May 2003 to August 2004. Pretty basically policing Baghdad. We did patrols, raids, checkpoints. We went to Fallujah, Anajaf, Sadr City, Al-Qut. Some of the things, I think the first thing that started me thinking and got me extremely opposed to the war was the living conditions, the daily life of the Iraqi people who we were supposed to be helping. I heard somebody say that their unit was rebuilding schools and hospitals, and that might be true, it might not, but I know at the same time, while they were rebuilding one school, I was tearing down four. And bombs were coming in, and dehumanization is a big thing with the troops over there. We are taught not to connect with the Iraqi people. We're taught not to view them as human beings. That's why it's common in the military to call Iraqi people Hajis, similar to Vietnam, where the Vietnamese people were called Gooks, because you're disconnected from them. But as a human being, I couldn't look at the same kids, the same people every day for 15 months and not make a connection with them. Some of those little kids that would come come up to you and ask for a handout or just say hi. You grew to love those kids, and I look on the news when I get back and see bombs dropping on Baghdad, and I think that maybe one of those kids that I saw as maybe a little brother or a little sister, it just got blown up, you know. You also see or have friends die over there. My best friend was killed over there, and a week later I was handed a box full of 240 machine gun rounds that were stained with his blood, and told to use them on the Iraqis because that would play on my rage at the fact that my friend had been killed in an ambush. And there is a lot of building going on in Baghdad and in Iraq. But it's not for the Iraqi people, it's not for the civilians, it's for the occupation. There are permanent camps going up in Iraq by Halliburton employees who are making $130,000 a year to do the same job that soldiers could be doing, making $22,000 a year. There are so many reasons to say that this war is wrong, and I still haven't heard one concrete good reason why we should be fighting this war. And I can't see why the American people can sit by so blindly and accept this atrocity. Apathy is one of the things that myself as a soldier, somebody who went and bled and fought and killed for this lie, apathy is like an insult to me. You can come up to me and tell me you're against the war, and I'll tell you I don't care because you're just going to go home and sit on your couch and watch the news unfold, the bullshit news. And sometimes I draw a blank. You kind of get caught back in the moment. When I came back, like a lot of soldiers, and I think probably all soldiers, you get caught in a place where you're numb and you're drawn away from everything, even your family. It took years, 2 years, before I could speak to my family about what happened over there. And this is something that all soldiers are dealing with. They're dealing with PTSD, and they're worried about whether or not they were subjected to depleted uranium. But the VA is not testing for depleted uranium. American soldiers, you know, when they come back, they're supposed to be proud, stoic, honorable. American soldiers, you know. You know what an American soldier is. Everybody knows, right? That's what they tell you they are on the news. They don't tell you about the problems. And I'll have a guy walk up to me with his 14-year-old son, and his son will be beaming because this is an American soldier, right? He gets to talk to a hero, and he'll ask me if I killed anyone. This happened to me. A 14-year-old kid asked me if I killed anyone, and I didn't want to tell him that I had, and a lot of or some of the people I did were his age. But this picture that we've given, that the U.S. government has given us to portray the soldiers is bullshit. It's one of their best achievements, because not only do they do a great job of dehumanizing the enemy, they do a great job of dehumanizing soldiers. We're taught, I mean, we don't go up. I've never had somebody come up and ask me how I was feeling today. When they found out that I was a soldier, how was I feeling today, or how many friends did you lose, or what are your thoughts on the war? Because I'm a soldier, right? I'm for the war automatically. That's a given, right? Obviously, that's wrong.
I asked Steve. He said that he wouldn't mind if we talked about what happened yesterday.
Yesterday we had a little incident, Steve. suffers from PTSD, and he wasn't really aware of how serious it could be. Obviously, just the fact that he has it, just the common symptoms of PTSD are pretty horrible. But yesterday, Steve began having a serious panic attack, and then the whole incident lasted about 3 hours. He felt like he couldn't breathe. He started to fade out and become numb. His hands were, he had extreme pain in his hands. He couldn't move his hands. And honestly, he thought he was gonna die. And this was from PTSD. This is how serious PTSD is. And soldiers are coming back and they're not getting proper treatment for this. They'll come back with PTSD and maybe be made to wait 3 months before they can even see someone who can begin to treat them for it or even begin to diagnose them.
It's like the amount of blood flow and adrenaline that was pumping through Steve, like that's what you use on the battlefield. And we were riding on a bus on our way to see Shakespeare in the Park. And they never teach you how to deal with that when you get back. They brush you aside. They make you feel like like you couldn't take it. Should have never joined the army. You couldn't take it. But it's the best soldiers that get themselves up to that level in combat. They can psych themselves up so much they can control their heartbeat and everything. There's an old saying, good soldiers make bad civilians or something like that.
Questions as I did and expressed the same thoughts that I did. My best friend who died, he told me personally that we didn't belong here. This was not right. This was not a war for soldiers to die, and there was no purpose. And when I got back to the States, I was supposed to go visit his parents, his family. And they're extremely patriotic American family, but I decided not to go because I couldn't tell his family that on top of his son dying, his son died for no reason. And his son knew that, or their son knew that. The question I get asked a lot is, what can I do? And I don't have all the answers. What I'm here to do is let you know what's going on and open your eyes to reality. But Americans, for the most part, once they get past the propaganda and the rhetoric, are intelligent people, and they can figure out where to go from here. There are so many different things you can do. But sitting by and being apathetic about the whole situation is unacceptable.
It's like your guess is as good as ours. We were sleeping in D.C. for 3 weeks. Like Steve said, he'll give us a bus. We drove across the country to some guy's house we didn't know and got a bus and started driving around with, on the tour with these guys. This one guy, he was on CNN because he just put a poster in his window saying how many people got killed in Iraq. It's like, you can figure out something to do. Wear a t-shirt that says stop the war and walk around.
It's like the American citizens have forgotten that that the masses hold the power, that we run this country. And it's been given over to the elitist and the people who are now in power who are abusing this. And it's so easy to take that power back, and we just won't do it.
My son is 18, and his good friend is on his way to Iraq now. And the thing that got him, this boy, was that the recruiter would meet with him at the cafeteria at high school and really got to know him, was real personable. And so the sell was that he was able to refer to things that this boy had said, like, well, you know, yeah, your sister screwed up in school, but this will really help, you know, your parents. They won't have to pay for your education. And he got to know him in that way. I wondered if that had happened to you with the recruiters, or if it was more, you know, was there some moment where it was just like, yeah, this is what I want to do? Was there something they said that kind of hooked you?
That was a recruiter's dream.
Yeah.
For me, no, it was extremely sudden. It only took a few days for me to make that snap decision and then go in. But being at the recruiting station, there were people there who, that was like their hangout. They just, and they were, had an actual personal relationship with a recruiter. The recruiters would take you out to a club or buy you beer or do whatever was necessary to get your trust. The recruiters to me are like used car salesmen. They have a quota and they'll do whatever they need to make that quota.
I have a question to ask you. Unfortunately, the general public knows nothing about depleted uranium. And you said that they're not doing any depleted uranium for the military, which is like enough to make you, you know, a little bit tight in your mind. Have you been able to be tested yourself in some way? Is there any other way you can get tested for this to be able to combat it in case it might be? So that you, when you said, you know, everybody's worried about when they come back, because we know there's a lot of depleted uranium, and that's what we're leaving with the Iraqi people too. So I'm wondering if there's a way, you know, for you when you get back, if there's a way for you to find out. Is there a way?
As far as I know, I was on deployment in 2001 or 2002 for Afghanistan. I might be a couple weeks off or whatever, but it shows up in your urine for like 1 to 3 months, and then your blood for like 2 years, and then it attaches to your spine, and there's really no way to test it. So anybody that hasn't been tested within that 2 years, I mean, they might be able to do a spine with that, but that's like me, Mike, anybody that's been home for 1 to 2 years. I mean, that's why it's so important to get the testing, is because if we get it done any longer than that, it's going to be impossible. So it's, you know, and then when we die from it, they don't have to pay us benefits anymore.
Is there any way to do anything about it if they do find it?
Stop using it, you know.
I know that. We wish that would never, ever happen.
And they can choose not to have kids at that point.
No, I meant for a reversal. I didn't mean for you to choose how that, you're running your life. Yeah, I mean, that's a
problem too. If I understand correctly, you know, like when you look at the side effects of DU, it's just like 20 pages of just like anything, you know, like any side effect that anything could ever give you is what DU supposedly gives you. And like, the reason why we don't know a lot of effects is because nobody's telling us. And what I was going to say was that, as far as something that they can do for you, it's like any other agency except for like the Department of Defense doesn't call it depleted uranium, they call it nuclear waste. And what it is like there's one of the atoms, you know, that is composed of depleted uranium, it's like a radical ion, and it just tears through things, like it tears through your DNA and everything like that, so I don't think like drinking tea or anything like that's going to help us. You know, it just, it tears through your system, moving them all over the place.
But they should get paid for it.
What creates the depleted uranium? Where does it come from?
It's left over from their power plants. Uranium, you enrich uranium, what's left over is depleted.
It's used as a
armor piercing bullet.
As an armor piercing.
It's heavier than lead, just like...
You put it inside the bullets, like munitions, like over 25 millimeters, not everything uses DU, mm-hmm. but there are a lot of weapon systems that use depleted uranium, and they put it, it's like a rod inside of the bullet, and when the bullet is fired, it's this long rod that's like denser than lead, and it catches on fire, and when it goes inside the armor, like it'll penetrate armor, and it like ionizes or you know, liquefies or whatever, it's just like this flaming piece of something harder than lead that punches
Does
right through.
Does the military deny that they use this?
No, they say like, if you look at like old World War II films of like guys running into the, you know, the fallout of atomic bombs, you see afterwards they'll be like brushing each other off with brooms and saying, go ahead soldier, you're all right. And I had a friend that was a fire patrolman and he handled it all the time and they told him to wear gloves and he'd be fine. So that's what they're saying. Like, there was this one quote from the, some general was talking about depleted uranium, and he was saying that something about, he quoted the World Health Organization about the use of, Bill Clinton authorized the use of depleted uranium in the Balkans. And he said that the general quoted the World Health Organization and saying that after studying, you know, the World Health Organization studying the Balkans, they found no higher levels of radiation and, you know, the atmosphere was fine or whatever. And then that's what he quoted. So I went to the World Health Organization and I looked up, you know, his reference, and he quoted that word for word, but he didn't include the rest of the sentence. And it said, however, something along the lines of mounds of loose dirt were found 15 miles from the crash, and the groundwater from the site is permanently contaminated and should never be used again. So, you know, just how did that dirt get there? Because that's like the only place that they really allow people to go out and test.
While we're on the subject of depleted uranium, Toby, you want to tell folks about what happened at the Pentagon a few weeks back?
Yeah, myself and three other vets, as well as Tristan, an activist that was with us, I think he's here today, went to the Pentagon. They were having a memorial open house for 9/11, and we brought flyers with the harmful effects of depleted uranium information on them. And when we got to the checkpoint, they told us that we weren't allowed to hand out any flyers. So we said, okay, we continued with the tour and went inside. And when we came out, we were surrounded by police, Pentagon police. And we asked if we were being detained, and they said, yeah, they had a warrant from, U.S. Attorney General. I mean, this whole thing lasted about 10 minutes, this whole tour, and they had already called down a warrant from the U.S. Attorney General. And we came outside and told us that somebody had left flyers inside the Pentagon, and that if we didn't tell them who it was, they were going to arrest anyone holding flyers at the moment, which was absurd because obviously we still have a flyer if we didn't get inside. So they arrested the four who were holding the flyers, and as we were being arrested, the person who actually did leave the flyers came up and admitted to it. And so they arrested him too and took all of us to jail. And there's going to be, we have a hearing actually on November 17th. But it's kind of a funny story, but what really irritates me about the story, what really pisses me off, is that As a U.S. soldier, I was told that I went over to Iraq to defend our freedom of speech, and I come home and go to the Pentagon and get arrested for using my freedom of speech.
There were two charges. One was disobeying a lawful order, and the second one was posting of materials.
Did they know you were vets?
Yes, they did. We had our Iraq Veterans Against the War shirts on.
If I may say something, when you first got there, there was some police, the Pentagon police, that were trying to keep us together. They supported these guys. And then he walked off and talked to another commander or something. And I see him walking back and he's shaking his head no. So they divided him up into two groups. And then they moved him to another section before he went in. I was there also. And then they grouped everybody up with an extra amount of public citizens. And we rolled on in. And inside the, tell them about the, because the chapel and the propaganda.
Well, we went into the chapel and it was supposedly, they called it a multi-faith chapel. And there was a windowsill next to it with camo-covered Bibles and literature on how to survive as a Christian in the military.
Christian soldier
in the military. Yeah. And that's where the flyers were left. I guess what you're trying to comment on is the fact that there were nothing but Christian literature in this multi-faith chapel.
Is it just us, or shouldn't everyone in the Pentagon know the effects of DU?
The rest of the world does.
Yeah.
I wonder how successful you've been in getting the mainstream media to pay attention to your stories. As you travel here and elsewhere.
They're scared.
Yeah. We don't deal with mainstream media. It's to us.
This group of us, we happen to be the most radical, probably, of our members, so... What's going on in the organization, people do their own thing, and some people spend hours and a lot of time and money trying to get on CNN or whatever, but we try to go from the bottom up, I guess. That's just us.
I've been giving a lot of media attention to the Pentagon Five, though. Like, within 4 hours of us getting out of jail, we were on CNN, and we were on, there was a press conference the next morning, numerous interviews, radio, et cetera, et cetera.
But it wasn't a planned arrest, and right. We contacted media beforehand, and it just happened.
I'm just curious, see what they had down there.
It's just something so disgraceful, it couldn't help but be leaked.
While you're driving around on the bus and everything, going to different cities, what's helpful things that people, like, is there stuff, supplies or things that are helpful for you guys when you're on the road, or like gas cards or things that, you know, you could think to put in someone's, basically supplies or things that people can do that we have access to that can just be like given to you, obviously money, but anything else people might have large access to, like
money. Is I can't fit that much on the bus, you know, but it eats up a lot of gas, and
obviously we're nomadic, so as far as materials and anything large goes, it's not really a lot we can do with it, but we do need gas money to get that things.
5 miles a gallon. Old Ford bus, 35-footer. I try to draft vehicles to get a little more. I'm the driver. coast downhills, put the clutch in.